I am your host, Jack Spierko, and we have a great lineup of stuff to talk about. This is our third edition of Monday Mayhem. I don't see it going away anytime soon. I'm enjoying the approach that we take on Monday Mayhem. This is where we kind of go almost old school TSP. Lots of topics, lightning fast. We rip right through it, kind of off the cuff comments, similar to back when I was in my car podcasting. If you're new around here, you may not know that from June of 2008 until December of 2009, I did this show from a car. Yeah, so 2006.5 Jetta Diesel TDI, where I was going down the road yelling at ass clowns on my 55-mile commute on a daily basis to the companies I was running up in Frisco, Texas, traveling there from Arlington. And then on this, it was the day before Christmas Eve of 2009 that I signed off of doing mobile podcasts. Done a few here and there for fun, but that's when we moved to a full-time show, and we've been doing that ever since, you know, first day we came back on January 2010 was the first episode from a home studio. So, little TSPC history there. So, let's, like, dig right into it. We don't do any lead-up to anything here. Like, if you didn't read the live promo, you don't know what we're talking about. Maybe I don't know what we're talking about. We're going to just talk about it. We're going to start off with a question I do keep getting. And I've, like, meant to answer it a few times, and then I didn't. One thing or another would come up and kind of push it aside. And that question is, Jack, you've explained who would buy a Bitcoin ETF instead of just buying and holding Bitcoin. And you know, that's basically you have captive funds. You had an IRA, 401k, something like that with a brokerage option. I think that makes sense. Or you have money that is in some sort of charter where it cannot directly purchase Bitcoin. That's what ETFs are great for, and it opened up the opportunity to hold Bitcoin in retirement accounts and other things for a lot of people. So I think that one's easy to understand. But you're right. I haven't really explained why somebody would buy Strike, STRC, which is a product and an individual stock, basically a bond instrument from MicroStrategy. And I've simply said it has a place. And one day I'll talk about it. So now I'm going to do it. Just if you're not familiar with this product, it is a variable rate, but their mean target is to keep the interest rate about 10% and the price per share at $100 USD. And they do this by leveraging Bitcoin. And that way they can make the gains on Bitcoin, remove the volatility for the investor is the way that MicroStrategy markets it. So you don't have to deal with Bitcoin's extreme volatility. They absorb it, and they're able to pay a very good interest rate, probably better than just about anything else. And there's been a lot of talk. It's going to go bankrupt. It's going to crash. And, like, they had enough money to pay dividends if Bitcoin stayed, you know, way below where it was for 2.5 years in cash alone, let alone the almost million Bitcoin the total group of entities holds. So that was all nonsense, of course. All of a sudden, everything's – the band is playing again. The Bitcoin prices rebounded up into the 70s, touched 80 a couple times. Everything looks great again, and people are asking about it. But who should do this? People that want cash flow. That's who. People that want cash flow without divesting themselves of their money, their equity. That's who. So here would be a perfect example. Let's say you had a person nearing retirement. And they have about $4 million in total assets for retirement. A advisor might tell them you can sell this much every year and live until you die and you'll never run out of money. Or you can sell this much every year and you can live to be 98, right? And if you get past that, well, you know, it won't really matter. And those are usually the approaches that they take. Some people have snapped to this retirement loan leverage idea. And I think that we're just not where it works yet. But I think those products are coming. And that is where we borrow against the equity and we pay it back with part of the loan. And then we refinance it every year or every 3 years. That has some implicit risk to it. And I understand it takes active management. What Strike does is you put money in it right? And I'm not talking about Strike, the app that you use to buy and sell Bitcoin and make payments with. I'm talking about Strike, the stock. Again, STRC is the stock, and it is something within the the strategy group, the MicroStrategy, or just Strategy Now group. It pays roughly 10%. Sometimes it pays 11%, 12%. And what they're doing is they adjust that rate to attract more money into the fund so that they can try to keep the price up. And here's the beauty of it. Let's say it was right at $100 a share like it's supposed to be. You put in $1 million, right? And it goes down to 90 bucks. And they are going to pay you your dividend anyway. You don't have the money in there for the equity gain. You have it in there for to make it relatively stable, to remove the volatility and the anxiety, but mainly to have an income stream. So let's say that you had a person, and let's say that person, again, had a $4 million portfolio at retirement. And people would say, well, it's risky because it could go to zero. It's not going to go to zero overnight, folks. You have time to get your money out if you pay attention. And it's probably never going to go to zero anyway, because the way that it's built makes sense. You would take maybe 25% of that $4 million portfolio. You put it into Strike, and it pays $100,000 a year. You can live pretty good in retirement with $100,000 a year income stream off of dividends. And that is one way that it might work. Another way would be you could be inside a 401k or something like that, or an IRA, and you could keep doing it. You could do it inside. You can buy STRC inside there. Now, it does mute a little bit one of the huge benefits of this, because the other thing it is a tax-free until you recoup your initial investment. So if a person puts $1 million in this product and they get $100,000 in dividends this year, you would think they're going to pay income tax on that. They wouldn't. They pay zero. It's getting your own money back is the way that the instrument is set up with the tax code. And then the next year they get another $100,000. Guess what? No tax. When they had a total of $1 million in payments, then every dollar after that that came out of it, or if you liquidate the underlying security, would be taxable. And if you bought it for 100 and sold it for 100, it would all become taxable at that point if it wasn't in some other tax deferred account, because you've already gotten the tax advantage. That's how it is. It's kind of like a first out tax system. I don't remember exactly what they call it, but it's quite useful when structured properly. Because you could leave the underlying principal in there after those 10 years, and you just pay tax on the dividends after that. You see how that works? And then your heirs would pay tax based on the day they receive it and the rules of the system, as if they would do it the same way you would if you decided to take it all out. That's who would do it. There is nothing in it that doesn't make sense. There are models that you can run on the Strategy website and look at how healthy the system is. It's the most public-facing, honest disclosure I've seen by any sort of investment vehicle ever, where they actually build ways for you to try to break it, for yourself on their website. So you go check that out. Now, disclosure, how much of this do I own? Absolutely none. Why? That's not my goal right now. Cash flow on passive investment is not my goal. Equity, I'm in my 50s, right? I'm still in equity game mode, right? So I don't mind the volatility, and I hold most of my Bitcoin not in any sort of deferred account. So if I sell it, I have to pay tax on it. So even if I convert it, I have to pay tax. Like, this is not a simple decision. Let's say, I have $4 million worth of Bitcoin, and I want income off of it. If I sell $1 million, I'm going to pay capital gains on, whatever the gain is on that $1 million worth of Bitcoin. So that might push that out, and that person might look more at the loan to value rate relationship and create an income strategy that way. This is not like everybody go buy this. And I hate anybody that gives anything approaching investment advice that's like, everybody should own this. You're retarded. You can't know that. In fact, I'm sure John Pugliano would back this up. A licensed, financial advisor or certified chartered financial analyst, anybody like that in that business that would make a broad recommendation to their clients, everybody buy this, lose their certification or their license, because you have to analyze the individual's goals, the individual's risk tolerance. Like, this is This is formulaic. So these ass clowns that get on it, just do this and just do that, don't listen to them. If they don't give you that disclaimer, forget about it. Move on, find somebody else to listen to. All right, real quick today, let's talk about today's sponsors of the show. Sponsor of the day number one today is Canine Academy. That is Joel Ryle's company. Joel's an awesome guy. I've known him for a very long time. And he has always just been a stand-up guy. I mean, I just, you know, kind of where I'm going with it right from the beginning is that Joel is a guy you can trust. He's also an incredibly gifted canine trainer. And I have trained dogs my whole life, and I consider myself to be pretty good at it. I've learned so much from Joel. And the thing about teaching people to do something, it's not very scalable if people have to come to you and you have to dedicate your time every time you train a new person or a new group. But if you put training online, you can make it scalable. That's what he's done with canineacademy.us. Check him out. If you wouldn't mind, it'd be great if you go by my website and use the link from the website or the banner from the website there because of the agreement that I have with Joel on how I get compensated. But I don't worry about it very much. I just want you guys to know about this program, and I want you to know you can take a free course called the Problem Solving Library. And if you do that, you will get, you know, the feel for what Joel's training is like. And with that, you'll be able to make a better decision for yourself. Next up today, thecaseplace.com. I'm so glad we got these guys on board as a sponsor. They are going to give you access to the best hard cases you will find. Cases by companies like Hardig, SKB, Pelican, and others. Like super high quality stuff. And this is going to, you're going to save 50 to 80% on these products. They're either like overstock buyouts. Some of them are damaged that they were fully repaired and restored to the original. They have an incredible reputation selling on eBay, having sold thousands of items on eBay. That made, my vetting process for them very easy for me to do. And I want you to think about reasons to have this type of protection for your gear. And it's a very simple reason. Your gear is expensive. That's what it comes down to. You know, if you look at camera gear, tactical gear, optics, lots of equipment that we travel around with and we use in our daily lives as preppers, as business people, as content creators, it's very expensive. And because it's very expensive, we need to treat it that way, and that means we need to protect it. So check their gear out. What a great deal, too. I just came from an airport. I was up in West Virginia. I saw a lot of cases like this on the turnstile. People understanding it's important to protect your equipment and your gear. And guess what? They probably paid twice what you would pay. So check them out today at thecaseplace.com. All right, let's get back into it. Trump has said he's going to do something that if he does it, I will forgive most of the bullshit he's pulled. I just don't trust him to carry through on it. And what's interesting is Trump hates Thomas Massie, and this is basically an EO version of the SAVE Act, is what it sounds like more. Not the SAVE Act, I'm sorry, the Prime Act. And this is about beef being overpriced. And Trump puts out this statement, and he said it's basically come to his attention that there's these four companies that are very nasty in the way that they enforce a monopoly on processing, creating a bottleneck of beef processing in the country. One of the most accurate things the Orange Man has ever said. I don't know who told him that, but thank you for letting him know. I'm just concerned this would all be a PR stunt. And basically he's saying, I want to set it up so that the ranchers can process their own beef and sell it. And not just the way the loopholes we have now and the ones we talked about last week where you have to cut multiple checks and do all kinds of weird things or only self-process and then only sell quarters. Like literally so a farmer could process and send the meat straight to a store as packaged ribeyes or even sell primals to stores that still cut their own primals down. And the objection has been these guys are not going to want to do it because they don't have time. And this is what people, I think, don't understand. When they read something like that, they're thinking about Bill, who has 10 acres and two cows, right? Bill is not who this is for. This is a big money business. These people have money and they will make investments. And the other thing is there's nothing that prevents them from creating basically under this would be like a regional conglomerate where everybody goes in on funding, right? And you can create a overriding brand and everybody still independently owns their farms. So you could have like a Texas Clean Beef Ranch LLC or something like that. The facility could be on one farm, right? And technically the other farms are under there, but you create an operating agreement. I don't want to get into the legalese that you could scale that. So you could have like 10, 20 ranches under that umbrella, all funding the labor, the material, all of that stuff. And now you've got some. And if you get about 30 or 40 of those up and running, now you've got something. Yes, a co-op model for meat processing. It's what it is, but it wouldn't legally be structured that way. There'd be and again, I don't want to get into pretending I'm a lawyer or something, but I know enough about corporate structure. I used to be a partner in a holding corporation, and we had five companies in that corporation. Okay, and then I was the president and majority partner in one of those sub corporations underneath that holding corporation. And I was able to run that entity any way I wanted with oversight from the holding corporation. I was also on the board. I'm talking about it'd be different, but that type of a structure, because the individual ranchers are going to want protections so that they can't be overridden and controlled by the umbrella company, because that's really what you're talking about here. But this absolutely can work. And dare I say, this needs to not just be done for beef. That's what's that, and this is why I think it's kind of like, I don't trust you, Trump, because this is about processing meat. Because if you think the beef processing's bad, the chicken, there's a lot more facilities, but the federal regulations and the regulatory capture is even worse. If I want to start a chicken processing facility, it is easier in some ways than if I wanted to go compete with Cargill with beef cutting. But I have to employ an FDA inspector to be on the floor with his own office, and I have to fund, like, he gets corporate salary, I'm federal salary, federal benefits, federal, like the same health insurance that somebody working in D.C. Is like a clerk for the FBI gets, okay? But I have to pay that, even though technically the government pays him. That's how it works. He has to have a dedicated office, and those facilities run 24/7 in three shifts, swing shifts. So I have to hire three of them. I need one on the night shift, I need one on the day shift, and I need one in the middle shift. No shit. That's bullshit too. And so that makes it cost prohibitive to process chicken. I'm going to go through all that shit. No, Tyson, Purdue, et cetera, they're the conglomerate that controls that market. And I would say, you know, pork, we need the same type of thing with pork. And bigger yet, a lot of these big mega processors now are owned or partially owned or majority owned by countries like China. This should not be the case. It's a national security issue. If Trump does this and he does it in a way that actually makes it work, I will forgive a lot of stupidity. More on Trump stupidity coming to you soon. Let's talk about flock cameras for a minute. This just did this in a past Monday Mayhem. And I said, I think this might be a little bit of a psyop, or maybe it wasn't planned that way, but now the best deal is to make it that way and let Flock take the beating. The mass surveillance isn't going to stop. People have gotten into their head that mass surveillance is Flock cameras. And that's a problem, and it's backwards, right? Mass surveillance isn't Flock cameras. Flock cameras are mass surveillance. And what does that mean? If the camera itself is mass surveillance, then the only thing you got to do is get rid of the camera and the mass surveillance goes away. And in one brand of camera that is conveniently easy to identify. Okay. Now that's not how this works. It's not how this works at all. You're like, hello. What is the IQ of a person that thinks that way? I bet you some of them have a pretty high IQ. They just haven't thought it through. They get attached to something. And remember, one of the keys to manipulation and control of a population is, in general, a massive angry mob can only really be mad about one thing at a time. And you notice that the charge that's being led isn't like mass surveillance is bad. Flock cameras are bad because they're mass surveillance. Those are very different psychological messages. All right. So what has happened is people have zeroed in on this, and this is the good part. Cities and counties, all and some private entities even that have had contracts with Flock are canceling contracts because so much blowback is happening. And again, I'm all for it. I just want you to realize it's not going to go away. And somebody who is going to go away very soon, at least from Washington, D.C., who I just mentioned under the last segment, Thomas Massey, he just recently posted something pretty much saying the same thing. He's like, Flock, getting rid of Flock cameras won't stop this problem. We need legislation to stop this problem. But I think we're going to get legislation, and you're going to use Flock as like a sacrificial lamb, or maybe let Flock back in the fold under this new regulation. They're going to create some sort of regulation that says any municipality that uses this technology, they're going to have to buy technology with certain safeguards. Some of the shit Flock said they're going to – like they found Jesus and they're going to do these things. But I think one might be like that you literally cannot use it without a warrant. You have to have a warrant to use it for a specific purpose. And this would prevent things like, you know, cops cyber-stalking their ex-wives and their girlfriends and shit, which is one of the main things we've heard about illegal use. But if they're doing that, right, and that has no defensible legal purpose, then how many times do you think they're using it to investigate actual crimes? And then if they find anything that sort of lines it up, then they go get the warrant, right? And they can't say, oh, we illegally use the surveillance system to get the information. But once you have certain bits of information, you can go out and hunt down some corroboratory evidence and use the corroboratory evidence, or at least you have a valid theory now. In other words, we believe this suspect went from here to here, and he's already suspected of this thing, so we would like a warrant. But they could never get that warrant approved if they weren't cheating on the back end. And I know some of you might be thinking, but Jack, you're sounding like you're defending criminals. That's what they want you to think. Because as long as there's a loophole, it will be used. Now, I'm not saying that requiring the warrant for the machine to even give you the data will fix all the problems, but it would be a step in the right direction, and it's something you can sell to people. Because I know what's going to happen next. But what if there's a little girl and somebody just saw her and they don't have time to get a warrant? They'll do something like, you know, a person with the rank of deputy chief or higher can sign off on immediate use, and then a proper warrant has to be sought after the fact. Right. And if it's not clear, let's say like the guidance to the courts would be if it isn't clear that this was done for a true emergency, the warrant is to be denied. And maybe you rescue the kid, but you can't use the evidence from that alone or evidence obtained because of that in a prosecution. And then they'll say, well, look at how we're just protecting criminals again. Right. Like no matter what you do, there will always be that pushback. I don't think we can trust it. If you look at just look at what was going on almost 20 years ago now when the whole Edward Snowden thing went down. If you've never seen the movie about that, you should go see it because it's worse than you probably think it is. And if you're young enough, like say you're in your 20s or 30s, right, like early 30s to mid 20s right now, you don't have enough memory of it to even understand what happened. So if that shit can happen, and basically that was they had these systems that they could get data on people from that there were supposed to be FISA warrants for, right? The hidden, which is already like anybody can really get one. And one of the things that pissed Snowden off is the CIA was just using it all the time with no warrants. And they were using it for really nefarious shit, like to identify somebody that they wanted to turn and then figure out exactly where their limitations and weaknesses were and then do something like, oh, I don't know, find out where their daughter was going to go to a bar, send in a good-looking dude to buy her a bunch of drinks, get her fucking soused off her ass, and then help her get in her car to drive and have her picked up in a foreign country by a foreign country's police force and then pull that guy go in and go, hey, you know, we could make that all go away for you. Or she could just take her chances in the, you know, Czechoslovakian or the Yugoslavian court system. That's the kind of shit that was going on under the prison program. All right. That's ancient. They have way better tech today. And I'm telling you right now, all those traffic cameras are already recording all the same data, and they're just in a separate network, and that can always be amalgamated back together. In fact, the reality is in most places without Flock cameras, you could already do the things that they say they need Flock to do. Flock is a mass surveillance tool. Don't get me wrong, but it's not mass surveillance in itself. And I don't know what we're going to be able to do to actually prevent it, because I don't think you're going to. And I think anybody selling you like information product or whatever that says you can escape mass surveillance is full of shit. Full of shit. Full of shit. I mean, if you want to go and live a little like the Unabomber, maybe somewhat. But if you are going to drive on public streets, if you are going to go places, if you're going to buy things without cash, if you're going to pay your bills online, if you're going to do any of that shit, you are in the mass surveillance system. And it's important that you understand that so that you don't get taken advantage of by people that promise you there's a way out, because there isn't. And I've seen a lot of that shit lately from some people that in general I like, but I don't like what you're doing right now. And it's making it where some of those people I will not be able to work with in the near future if it continues. I won't say who, just when I'm not working with them, maybe you'll know, maybe you won't, but I won't be working with them. Moving on. I want to talk about trolling in a lake, you know, like for fish with a rod, and you get the boat going about 2 miles an hour and you put the downriggers out, except not that kind of troll. The orange troll, the goat of trolls, the orange man himself, Donald Trump. And I'm not going to in any way defend what this idiot's doing here. But Lake America is now a thing. I wasn't paying much attention the last 2 weeks. I was getting ready for the relaunch of the AI course, getting ready for my trip up to West Virginia. You know, going through my talk, and like I was just kind of like on the side paying attention to what's going on in the news. And I heard all this stuff about renaming Lake Ontario Lake America, just like at the very beginning of the Orange Man's term, he renamed the Gulf of Mexico Gulf of America. And I was like, is that real? And I'm like, I don't have time to track this down. So I went to Google Maps. And I zoomed in on Lake Ontario, and on Google Maps, it says Lake America. Oh, my God. This is the thing about doing this. What is the purpose other than a troll? It's juvenile. It's sub-adolescent. It doesn't make any sense. He's acting like a child throwing a tantrum because he didn't get the trade conditions that he wants, and he's doing something that only will enrage and piss off the Canadians. It will do absolutely nothing. Like, it's not like, hey, you know what? If you take the deal, I'll turn it back. And, you know, the Canadian government's basically already said the rest of the world's going to call it Lake Ontario. The indigenous population of North America is pretty pissed off because Ontario, Lake Ontario wasn't named after the province of Ontario. It was named off after a tribe, which the province is also named after, okay? So this is not really about Canada. There's several of the Great Lakes that were named that have to do with the indigenous populations, Huron and Erie also as well. So, and I don't know, is Michigan? I think Michigan actually comes from an indigenous tribe as well. So I think the only one that isn't, and I'm not sure about Michigan, I didn't check, but I'm the only one I can say that really probably isn't would be Superior, because it just means like bigger and better than everybody else and on top, right? I don't get this one, but I do think that something might be going on. I had an interesting conversation with a couple of retired lieutenant colonels in West Virginia about this very topic at our meetup, and they said, you know, Trump, this idea that I'm about to explain has been around a while, like a long time, like the Monroe Doctrine was coast to coast, and there's this idea of north to south, the entire North and South American area, and not necessarily owned and controlled by the United States, but united enough to have, like, we don't need the rest of the world. An isolationist policy that incorporates, you know, what, a third of the world's landmass as not being isolated. And really to make this work, this is going to sound crazy, but the one thing you have to do beyond what you do on our two continents to make this work is you need to deal with Russia. You need a kind of a, not just even a peace treaty with Russia, right? Like over like the Ukraine shit and all. You need to peel Russia, which I've always said should be the goal here anyway. Peel Russia off China. Like the whole shit we pulled in Ukraine actually, you know, sent Russia to China and they become butt buddies now. So you got to pull them apart. Because if you do that, and you can maybe not call Russia allies, but you no longer see them as a rival. They're seen as, you know, just basically another country that you get along really, really well with, which is kind of the best way to run a country, especially if you're going to have the system that I'm talking about here. What you have then is complete control of the Arctic. If you have Russia on your side of things, you don't need Europe. Europe's screwed. Europe gets to do with their part of the Arctic whatever we say. And if you go all the way down, if you look at the natural resources available across those two continents, if your trade network is primarily countries within those continents, you don't need the rest of the world. You don't need them for oil. You don't need them for coal. You don't need them for natural gas. You don't need them for iron ore. About the only thing you might need anybody for is rare earths. But you know where you can get a lot of freaking rare earths? From Russia and from Greenland. And so this is kind of like a modern Monroe Doctrine. Instead of like, we need to take it all, we need to isolate it from the rest of the world sufficient that we don't need the rest of the world. Doesn't mean you don't trade with them. It doesn't mean we won't be buying shit from China and Japan or whatever. It means we don't have to. And if you think I'm advocating for it, I'm not. I'm just spelling out a theory. And when I looked at this, I said, but like, look, like all the shit he did in Ukraine, that doesn't help that plan. And some of this outlandish shit, like renaming a lake, which is the start of the conversation, doesn't. But they're like, but what if he's only doing his piece? What if he's only doing his piece? Like, and one of these guys, well, both of them listened to my show and was like, remember what you always say about the Uniparty. Like, you could have people come at it from different ways. So it doesn't matter if Vance or Rubio wins the next election. The next Democrat can take this and go to the next piece. In fact, in some ways, it would be easier. Hey, we're sorry about all that. Let's fix it now. Right. And that could be done with a Democrat. It could be done with a J.D. Vance. Like, hey, Canada, you know, I was the vice president. My job was to back my president, but I never completely agreed with the way that was being handled. Let's fix it now. So you create a new North American trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. And you do so in a way that's like, hey, we can't ever have this happen again. We have to have let's have a fixed equivalency of tariff. Everything that comes in and out is tariffed at the same rate in both directions. So it's truly fair. And it's still a source of revenue. And there's still some protection of local domestic production. That's the plan that these guys seem to think is possible. I'm not saying it's going to happen. And there's a lot of plans that don't happen. I think the idea that this is a plan, though, is real. I dug into it quite a bit. All right. Now, let's talk about something else that's going on right now. And of course, the media, anything that is even Trump adjacent has to be maliciously attacked, is being evil. And even if you're going to report it accurately, you write your headline so that, you know, most people won't read what's actually going on. Just see the headline and go, oh, it figures there's Trump being a fascist again. Right. So here's one of the headlines. This is in Newsweek. So this is mainstream as it gets. Thousands of H-1B workers could face rapid deportation under new Trump plan. Now, what does that sound like? Like Trump's going to throw out all the people on H-1Bs, doesn't it? Now, sadly, Trump is probably the most H-1B friendly president we have had in a long time. There's bucket loads of H-1Bs on their way to America right now under Trump. They're raising more money with the program because he raised the cost of it. But it hasn't slowed it down at all. And the H-1B people are everywhere here in Texas because it's such a strong growth economy. And there's a lot of tech sector, but there's also a lot of – you don't have to be a tech company to need tech workers. In fact, all large companies need tech workers. So, I mean, if you go to like an event, like a CEO event, like I went to a Christmas event over in a town called Grapevine, about 30 miles from us this Christmas. I'd say 10% of the people walking around were clearly Indian or Pakistani. And I'm not picking on those people. I'm just saying, like, you know, I got here. And we might have more H-1Bs in Texas than any other state in the country. I'm pretty sure that we do. And so you think it's a very conservative country, state and all. Conservative, yes, and then business-friendly, and that's a business-friendly thing, at least in our modern era, in the minds of the people in charge. But deporting them because they're H-1Bs is what that sounds like. It's not what it is at all. So 2016, one of the last things that Barack Obama got done before he handed things off to Trump, and Trump didn't pay attention to it at all, was a softening of requirements to remain here on an H-1B, specific that if, you know, the guy's working for a company and the company goes, I don't need you anymore, and your job goes away, it was a pretty quick trip back to wherever you came from unless you could immediately locate another job that was that qualified to use your visa. And they said, well, that's terrible. These poor people that are here as our guests under our program only because supposedly we need them. Their job went away. We don't need you anymore. Bye. That's how it was until 2016 under the existing H-1B program, which means it was that way for all 8 years of Barack Obama's term. So now it's fascist, but it was fine when Barack did it. It was fine when Bush Jr. did it. It was fine when Bill Clinton did it. You get what I'm saying? That's 24 years right there that this program was the way that basically Trump's going to put it back to. And all it is basically you don't get much time at all. You're out. Thousands could be deported because they're losing their job, which is the only reason they're here. So I'm not even taking a stance on that. I just think it's kind of important if you're going to have an opinion about something that, surprise, surprise, you know the thing that you have an opinion about and what it's really all about. All right, let's keep going here. I have a couple pop culture things for you that are interesting to look at to me today. One, I just started watching last night with my wife the new season of Reacher on Amazon Prime. It's, you know, it is what it is. It's enjoyable if you like action stuff. It's like a series, a seasonal series based on the novels, and a lot of over-the-top shit in it, but it's pretty damn good. It's very this season so far is very compelling, the mystery woven into it. I've only seen the first two episodes. But in the first episode, there's a guy who's a police detective that Reacher ends up in front of with his partner, who's like this Polly Sue black chick that's like his cohort in the whole thing. And she's the one that's like a main character in it, running around with Reacher and some other people trying to figure all this stuff out. And she's kind of sidelined into like the night shift, you know, worrying about suicides and shit like that, like how it really happened, which is the genesis of this. And they're having this talk, the older guy and the lady, and he's like 2 years from getting his pension. And he makes a statement that was the most accurate, quiet part out loud I have heard in a long time in something like this. So she's wanting to help out this thing. And he's like saying, hey, remember how you ended up sidelined by pushing where you shouldn't have? And then he says to her, and this is really, listen to this. He's talking about the fact their salary is currently dependent upon doing exactly what you're told, exactly the way you're told to, and basically being an inefficient fuck. Right? Like, we were put here to do this and ride out our term. All we got to do is ride out our term. We'll get our pensions and we'll go on with our lives. And this is based in Philly. So they have like that kind of pension, right? This is not the kind of pension. Like, my brother-in-law is a police lieutenant in Grand Prairie, Texas. His retirement pension is more like your 401k than anything else. Like, it's not go to this many years and then get this much money for the rest of your life like an annuity. It's not an old school pension. Philly still has those type of pensions. So I'll basically make no noise for another few years. And this is the line, right? And tell me this doesn't sum up our problems when it comes to all bureaucrats, including law enforcement. It's about the income, not the outcome. Let me say that again. It's about the income. He just tells her, remember, it's about the income, not the outcome. And they gloss right over it. And I'm like, that's the way they got it in there. It's the income. Now, think about how many awful things are done, not just by the federal government. Local governments, city governments, town councils, et cetera. And it might not be somebody worried about their pension so much, but it's about the income, not the outcome. How can we fund the schools and put in a bunch of new stadiums or something? Well, but what do we get out of it? Hey, it's not about the outcome. It's about the income. Summing up greed. So it sums up bureaucratic state greed better than anything else I've seen or heard in my life. If you got a better one, let me know. Put it in the comments here or send me an email about it. Remember, when you email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line, I am going to see your email eventually, even if it gets filtered into spam. All right, another one for you. And this one I actually had planned. The Reacher one, that just happened last night. I'm like, oh, that's going in. But the Unabomber is having another documentary made about him. Like, and I don't know if did the guy die or something. I don't remember. I know a lot of people have died recently. He is pretty old. But they have made quite a few movies and series about this whole chain of events. And Netflix is remaking it. And it does look, and I'm not going to play the trailer on air for you guys right now or anything like that, but it does look like they are going to be honest about the shit that happened to him as a teenager and a young adult with the MK Ultra program, which at least I will give Netflix that they're going to do that. And I don't know that you could tell that. I don't know if that's like an editorial decision because, like, we want to be honest. I think it's more like you can't really tell the story in a way that makes any sense without that component to it. But what did they do? What is the big change that they made? That really shows a political agenda that isn't really related to the Unabomber at all. The lead investigator, woman, Polly Sue woman, always right, in charge, has to fight with her male cohorts, yells and demands that things get done the way that she wants them done. Everything she tries to do is for right, but she is facing male opposition all the way. What's my problem with this? The core investigative team that investigated and caught the Unabomber not only was not led by a woman, there was no women on it. No woman really had anything to do with this. Now, why do I have a problem with it? If this was a fiction story, I wouldn't care. Basically, you're doing a docudrama series, right? This is real. This is something that actually happened. And of course, you always in a docudrama, you bring some things in that didn't really happen or things that were said that weren't that way or sideline stories or whatever. And that's fine. And you disclose that. But this is like an intentional, willful choice. And it just shows you more of what we're dealing with. The political narrative is more important than the factual reality. You can trust nothing you see on TV. And, you know, about once a week, they really, really, really remind you of it. This is our latest example of it. This is stupid. And there's no good reason for it. It's not going to make the story any more compelling. It's not going to make us all be like, oh, wow, now I have a whole new view of things because they put a woman in charge. All it is somebody that was behind the production felt the need. We need a strong female character in this role. Yeah, but the role wasn't a strong female person who did this. And I think it's very disrespectful to the people that really did lead the investigation to infer that it happened that way. Now, I want to say some things because whenever Uncle Ted comes up, we have two factions, and I think both of them are subtart. One is Uncle Ted is actually a hero. He foresaw everything that was going to happen, and he was trying to find – no, he's a fucking murdering piece of shit, okay? And then you get the other side is he's just a murdering piece of shit, and he's crazy, and we shouldn't listen to anything he had to say. You know what? Two things that seem to be in opposition can be true. He was a freaking genius. That is not my opinion. That's not anybody's opinion. That is based on standardized testing. Right. The guy's IQ was like off the chart level, Einstein level shit. Right. And like the guy wrote something like a 32,000 word manifesto without a single error. Now, I'm not talking about what he was saying in it, but I mean, not a single grammatical error, nothing noted or cited was incorrect. It was perfect. Perfect. And he wrote it on a fucking typewriter. Okay. In fact, it's a big part of how they caught him because the style guide he was using indicated certain things about him, like where he went to school, the time he would have went to school, and the level of IQ he would have had to be able to do what he did. Right. So if you look at what he said about technology controlling humans, he was spot on. If you look at his solution, and I don't even mean the bombs, like what we needed to do to prevent it, it's completely unrealistic. The man had serious fantasies, and his own ego was much bigger than his reality. Very, very smart, but he saw himself as like some sort of caveman, proto-caveman guy or some shit. Like, And the guy wouldn't have lasted a day in that. Like, he thought if we went back to primitive times, he would have been like one of the, you know, village chieftains or some shit. No, no. But if you actually, if you ever take the time to read his manifesto and you look at the diagnosis of the problem, it's as spot on as anything you'll ever see. But you're not going to put that, the technology genie, back in the bottle. There can be things learned from a maniac that can be used to mitigate the damage of something that's inevitable, because we are not going to go back to the way things were, let's say, in 1500. It's not going to happen. And I don't know about you, but I don't want it to. Like, I like the fact that I can talk to people all over the world like I'm doing right now with a laptop computer, a webcam, and a microphone. I like that. I like that I can run a business from my house that brings value to people all over the world. I like that. I like that I can get a fucking car and go get shit when I want it. I don't have to get on a horse and ride for 3 days to get supplies. I like that when somebody wants me to come to another state, I can get on an airplane and sit in a chair in the sky while somebody serves me a Bloody Mary and a beef rib. I like all that. I don't want that to go away, right? 229 Mix says we like that too. But if you look at what's happening, especially to our young generation right now, our Z's and our Alphas are aging into where they have more self-agency. The control that the internet and internet-based media has on these people, influencers, yes, but also like the mainstream media now is part of the influencer movement, right? They co-opt these influencers, and the narrative and control, like, people spend more time a day right now with a screen in their face than they do taking a walk outside. And I'm taking work out of that. Now, of course, if you enter data into a spreadsheet at work, I'm not even counting that. I'm counting the time that's yours to do with as you please. And the number one pastime in America is doom scrolling. And every piece of data that goes into your brain has a psychological long-term effect. It is programming. I've talked about this how many times? Programming. They call it programming for a reason, because that's what it is, just like you program a computer. So anyway, let's move on from there. What I'm going to be anchoring these with for the foreseeable future is a chapter from one of my books. And there's two Law of Life books, and I'm talking about the second one because it's the newest book in this first round of it anyway, because it's going to be 32 segments. I'm going to give you Law 2 from Laws of Life Book 2 today. And that is, everyone is an expert at a few things. And when I talk about that in the book, I open with a quote by Jim Rohn. And that quote is, we must all suffer one of two things, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. If we want to accomplish something, we have to do the hard things to accomplish it. And if we choose not to do that, then we are eventually going to get old enough and look back on our past and say, look what I could have done. And I'll tell you what's hitting me right now is some reality that it's more empathy for others than for myself. I'm pretty happy with the way that I've lived my life. But, you know, my wife and I discovered this TV series, which is pretty good. It's kind of stupid, but it's enjoyable entertainment, called The Rookie. And it's about this cop who goes and becomes a LAPD officer in his 40s. And it's kind of preposterous. And I started thinking about that and going, so you're in your mid-50s, bro. That ain't happening for you. I could go end up look. I could spend a year getting my body into shape and look like freaking Sean Baker or something. And I'm still not, I can't do it. If I wanted to become an attorney right now, I really can't any practical way do it. I mean, I could theoretically, there's no point to it. You know, you're talking about 4 years of undergrad, 3 years of law school, an externship and an internship in the bar. Right? You're looking at 10 years. I'll be, you know, actual full-on retirement age by the time I get there, and there's no point to it. I started realizing that there's a lot of things, and fortunately, I lived by that quote, and there's not something like look at that and go, I wish I would have. But I also look back at, you know, my teen years and my early 20s and think, if I knew what I know now, look at all the things I could have done back then. And then I think, what is that like for a person my age who is right now digging ditches, who is right now on a riding lawnmower working for a landscape company? who is right now, you know, maybe they're a supervisor or something, but they're like a middle manager, supervisor of some shit, and they don't even like it. And they had real potential and they had real ideas, and it's too late for them. Well, that has to suck. We all must suffer one of two things, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret, Jim Rohn. So frame it with that when I tell you that if you figure out the thing you're an expert at, that you're a genius at, you can either develop your life to a point where you can make a living doing it as an employment opportunity for someone else or as a business. And that someday, especially you guys that are listening to me that are 30, right? And you don't, you're like, I'll never get old. Yeah, you're going to get old. You make jokes about being old. You ain't old yet. 30. Get out of here, right? 25. But 25 to 50 will happen a lot faster than you think it will. And every day you don't becomes a day closer to the fact that you won't. So finding your genius in the right overlaps is key if you want to actually make something happen with your life, that when you're nearing its end, you can look back at your life and not only be grateful for the life you have, but feel proud of it and not live with deep regret. And one of the things I've always tried to, you know, get into this audience's mind on this show is that. And I've always said not everybody needs to be an entrepreneur, but you need to be doing something that builds the life you want. If you don't and you're not designing your life, somebody's doing it for you. So what I want to give you today, this chapter was a huge chapter, and it goes into multiple levels of things, and it invokes the Tim Ferriss 60-day expert or 90-day expert formula that Tim developed in the 4-Hour Workweek, how you could be a recognized expert in just a couple months. But it takes my expanded version I've put on the air before, and somebody just asked about it. As a coincidence there. And I went over it on the air. But what I did in the book, if you haven't gotten the book too, in the Laws of Life series yet, is very extensive. And it incorporates using AI, and it has both internal and external focused things along with Blended. What I mean by that is people that want the knowledge for the sake of the knowledge themselves, so you just follow all the internal ones. There's people that want the knowledge, but they also want to do something with it. So you want to focus on the external, the branding side of it as well, and it's your choice. And then some things are blended, like this is very good for the outward-facing thing, but it's also really important for the internal actual learning of knowledge. And so, but what I'll leave off with before we get into that, because that's too complex for a segment, that would be probably a two-part episode. It's so complex. Just that piece of that one chapter. But there are four questions I give you to first unlock and find your areas of genius. Question one, what do you really love to learn about and do? Like, if you see something about it, you are going to go investigate it. If you find a new book about it, you're probably going to buy it. If there's a workshop that you can go to and put your hands on and do it, you're going to do it. Not because you think it's fun or whatever, but like what I'm saying is if there were two and one was that thing and the other was something you kind of liked, but you would say that, like, you would probably do option B if it was the only thing there. But if I gave you a choice between B and A, you're like, A, just instantly you want to do that thing. What is that thing and what are those things? Usually it's not one thing for people. No, my law is not everybody's a genius at something. Everybody's a genius at a few things. We are a social creature, and we crave mental challenge, and we despise boredom. So all of us tend to be a little bit of a polymath in some way, right? Question two, what things do you do that when you're engaged in them, you lose all sense and track of time? Like, you look up and 4 hours went by. And I guess with when we talked earlier about the screen addiction, and something productive happened, right? Something productive came out of it. You can, like, I've seen people, I learned this and whatever, and I'm mad about that. And like, what did you actually learn? They don't know because they did, right? You either gained significant knowledge by that thing that lost track of time, or there's like an output that you're like, this is valuable, at least to me. What is that? Then, if you had more money than you could spend, I'm talking like, you know, Elon Musk money. You got more money. Like, if you went out and spent $10,000 a day for the rest of your life, you would still leave your family with more money than you started with. That kind of money, right? If you had so much money, you were living like Richard Pryor in that, what was the movie where he ran for mayor because he had to spend $30 million in 30 days and have nothing to show for it to get all, or $3 million in 30 days, something like that. He had to spend all his money and have nothing to show for it. I can't remember what that was called now. You had that kind of money forever. Okay. If you had more money than you could spend, what productive things would you do still? Would you still do? I traveled Europe. I did this and I did Brewster's Millions. That's exactly what it was. Brewster's Millions. So, I've done like the party thing. I've done the travel thing. And I just want something. I've got my new mansion and my property and my four wheelers, but like I need something to do. What are the things that you would do? And I'd ride my four wheelers all the time. There's money in four wheelers and not just selling them. I'm just saying. What are the things that you would do if you didn't have to work? What are those things? And then of those things, where is the overlap of your passion and market opportunity in that Venn diagram? Where can you say, I love this thing so much that I would do it even if I didn't need money, and yet this sliver of it overlaps those two things where there is a way to earn from it? And then you can monetize your genius. And I'm going to tell you the thing about monetizing genius. It's a much better opportunity. It's a much better thing to monetize than what most people monetize. All most people monetize is either their labor or their ability to mentally calculate things. You're either a battery and a calculator or an excavator with, two hands and 2 feet. In other words, you either manually do something, so you're selling your physical labor, or you mentally do something, so you're selling your mental labor, but you really don't give a shit about the thing you do. I'll put it this way. If I said, here's a check right here. Here's a check. And this check is for $10 million. If you would instantly never touch the thing you do for income again, I understand most people are like, I'd quit my job too if I had a job. You gave me $10 million. I'm not saying you, if you quit your job, it doesn't pass. I'm saying whatever it is you do, when you did sit down and say, okay, what do I do with the rest of my life? You'd say, one thing I know I'm not going to do is I'm never going to read TPS reports again. And that's your primary job. Then you need to do something else with your life, or you will be a 50-something someday. Think about all the things you could have done that you didn't do with a lot of regret. If you like that and you want to learn more about things like that and you want to learn how to do it, then you really do want to pick up a copy of Laws of Life Book 2. It's available on Amazon. You can just go to Amazon and search for Laws of Life Book 2, or you can go by today's show notes or my website, go to Jack's Laws and get a copy of it starting there and check it out. Again, this is the kind of stuff that we cover in it. And I want you to understand that chapter way deeper than what I just gave you. Like I said, there's an expert formula in that book to become an expert in 90 days in just about anything, and to do it for its own sake, or to do it because eventually you want to monetize it and you want to be able to reach out and say, so-and-so is an expert in fill in the blank. And here's how you can, here's your proof points to that. Because the world does care. You can't just say you're an expert. You do have to have proof points, and you got to have the discipline to get it done too. That this saying right here from John Willis on my t-shirt today, doing what you hate but doing it like you love it, makes a cameo in chapter one of that book as well. And I changed things up a bit. Doing what you hate like you love it. Well, we talked about that last week, so we'll let it go. Anyway, with that, I am ready to wrap up today. Got you in under an hour like I've been promising with these. And I didn't really see any questions come in today. But I do want to let you know one more thing is going to be coming pretty quick. I talked about, and it fits really well with this last segment, a AI-led course, but it's self-led, inexpensive. You buy it and just take it to find the business that's right for you. I've got that 80% done. I'm going to kick it over to Tom today to look at it, get some more critique from him, refine it and hand it to him to modularize it and put it into the website. I can't see us not launching that course in September. I just can't see it not happening. I can't see it not happening in two to 3 weeks, honestly. And I think it's going to be a fantastic course. It's going to be 15 days. And you, each day you do the one part. And it's designed to pace that way so that you have time to think between day to day to day. And what the output will be at the end of 3 weeks. a 60-day business plan. Exactly what to do first and where to go with it. I don't know where else you can get that for 50, 60 bucks, but we're going to make that available to you. We're going to do it really soon. Take care, guys. Again, pick up a copy of my book. And if you're not an MSB member, consider joining the MSB today. Just go to the website, thesurvivalpodcast.com/members, and learn more about it. Take care, guys. I will catch you tomorrow with a more traditional 2026 style episode of the Survival Podcast.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.